And halachically, we don't seem to have read it with anywhere near the freedom that I'm reading it. Right? So you look at source number 4, the Shulchan Aruch says straightforwardly, Ad heichan mora'am, how far is there awe? Hayah ben lavush chamudot v'yoshev brosh kahal, if the son is wearing fine clothes and sitting at the head of the community, and his father and mother came, tore his clothes, hit him over the head, and spat in his face, he must not humiliate them, rather he must be silent and be in fear, awe of the King of Kings who commanded him to do so. Yes?
Maybe you don't have to be obedient to your parents, but you have to be obedient to God. It's the mitzvah, and it's not according to God.
But it's really dangerous, right, to say that, of course you're not really supposed to, there's no real obligation towards your parents. Just, it's the divine right of parents. Whatever your parents say is commanded by God.
So, or you have to do the things that the Torah said you have to do to your parents.
Which include letting your parents come up to you in public, tear your clothing off, slap you in the face, and spit. Right, that'd be hard. Right? That would be, right? And this is a very dangerous line of Shulchan Aruch, which is sometimes used to assert that there is no defense against abuse whatsoever. Right? That really, right? If you on the one hand say that Yirah includes obedience, and notice that the Shulchan Aruch, that while the Gemara says that Heichan Kibud, the Shulchan Aruch translates it to Morah. So if you say that Yirah includes obedience, and you have here a claim that, you know, basically anything your parents do in the context of Yirah, your job is just to be silent and think of God commanding you to do this. And then you end up with a halakha which says you have no defense against abuse, and it's really very dangerous. Yes, Roger.
Well, it's interesting that the proof of this halakha in the Shulchan Aruch is this non-Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Usually your proofs are something that rabbi did.
Well, but here the rabbis held him up as a model. Right, that's Rabbi, right. How far does Kibbutz Avayim go? It goes as far as this. Right, that's why I'm interested in making a mesos.
Was there no Jew who was good at honoring his parents that they could find a model from?
Well, that's part of why I am tempted to see the echoes of Esav. But I should say that there's a film probably many of you have seen called Hiding and Seeking. Nobody here has seen Hiding and Seeking?
Yeah.
You've seen it, right? Menachem Daum. Right, it's a marvelous documentary. We should show it in the shul on perhaps on Tisha B'Av at some point. It's a marvelous film by an Orthodox filmmaker whose sons have become Haredi, and he notices that they have developed anti-Gentile attitudes. His sons are learning in Lakewood, and what he decides to do is to take them on a trip to Poland to meet the Polish family that rescued his father, or that hit his father during the war. Now, it's a beautiful film. I don't want to tip off that family has their own ambivalences, and whether they did it because they love Jews or not is, right, for other reasons, is ambiguous in the film. But one of the things that gets you in the film is that they go back and they meet this Polish Gentile peasant family, and obviously, the people who were teenagers when they hid the filmmaker's father are now elderly people, and you watch how the filmmaker's father is interviewed here, and you watch how he and his sons interact with his father, which is a very fine, pleasant, respectful relationship, and then you watch the Polish peasant family, where the elders are just filled with joy. Even though they're very old, and they're not, they're very old, and it's because the family runs their whole life around their happiness. And it's a terrifyingly intimidating vision of Kibbutz Avayim. And if you ask me, someone asked me, Ad Heichan Kibbutz Avayim, how far does it go? That was just, watching that film was just terrifying to me. Even though I have watched extraordinary instances of Kibbutz Avayim on the part of my own parents. So it might just be that was the best example. I don't have a better example. Watch that film as one of those things where you just feel just terribly inadequate watching it. And that's part of what the filmmaker is trying to do. Right? The goal of the film is to try and make an Orthodox audience experience what he was trying to make his kids experience. Okay, yes, Hannah.
I want to ask about the Shulchan Aruch, whether or not it's possible to make a distinction about dealing with your parents in the public versus private sphere. Because in theory, it could make a difference whether or not you're sitting, you know, Yoshev Rosh Shakahal, and it's a very public venue, not to humiliate your parents there, but if in a more private realm they were acting that way, whether or not that...
It's nice. Yeah, I would tend to think that the purpose of making it public is to increase the humiliation you have to absorb, rather than to say that, right, to, as a limit on what your parents, when you have to absorb it. But it's a nice defense. I tend to think not, but it's nice. Okay, yes, Jason.
A few things. One is that the Shulchan Aruch is calling it Mora. But that the Gemara was calling it Kibbutz.
Yeah.
So you could distinguish between Kibbutz and Mora.
Okay, and where will that get you?
What? I think it may not be Mishal.
So we can say, you can try to claim the Gemara called the Kibbutz, he calls it Yira, because Yira has no limits at all.
I'm just, may have different limits. May have different.
Also, okay. Yeah.
He didn't say, as far as payment goes, he didn't comment. He just said you shouldn't embarrass him. What you do after that is a different story. Meaning that maybe you can get a restraining order on your parents if you're going to come and do that all the time, but you can't publicly humiliate them.
Okay, so it could be about reaction. You can get a restraint. You can engage in self-defense. You just can't, right? But once it's done, you can't do anything, right? The marshal tries that with the purse also. He says that if your parents are grabbing for the purse, you can fight them off. But once they've thrown the purse in the ocean, you can't say anything to them, right? So we could try that. Yes, Yuda.
What if you went even further? What if you say you could sue your parents in court for being stated for the embarrassment you endured?
You can even sue them, you just can't embarrass them. Okay, right, so find his faces. Okay, we could try that. Lisa, did I not call on you earlier?
I'm sorry?
Did I not call on you earlier?
But, no, actually, you said what I was
going to do. Okay. Okay, what I'm going to try to do now is to say, let's take it so far as a worst-case scenario. That actually what we've done is we've set up a way in which you could have an unlimited, let's suppose that we establish an obligation of obedience, and in two sources we'll make it pretty hard to avoid the notion that there's some kind of notion of obedience. And let's assume that the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av V'Em goes that far, that you fulfill the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av V'Em, even right, by absorbing these things. What I want to do now is just go through a long line of ways in which that would not happen halachically, right? A line of halachic defenses against orders that somehow breach the proper boundaries. So here's the first level. So the Shulchan Aruch also says, right, this is a machloke between the Rambam and the Ravid. The Shulchan Aruch says that if your parents break down mentally, so you should make the effort to behave with them in accordance with their condition until God has mercy on them. But if it's not possible for him to stand, I'm sorry for the typo, because they have become greatly insane, he may go and leave them behind so long as he commands others to treat them properly. All right, so the first line of defense, and this is an issue which, you know, we should not know from it, but, you know, this comes up all the time with Alzheimer's issues, is what happens if it just becomes mentally unbearable to be around your parents. It doesn't say why. It doesn't seem to suggest that there's something that's objectively unbearable, because then what good does it do to appoint somebody else? Right? It just means that there's something about the relationship that makes the situation unbearable. So at that point, even though we seem to rule there is an obligation of service, at that point you have the right to hire a substitute. Right, that's the first defense, and that can be generalized in some sense, meaning that there is a time at which a relationship becomes unbearable, you are entitled to substitute someone for yourself, so long as the services are performed. Okay, yes, Roger.
Yeah, question,
who pays for that?
Correct.
Right, so it sounds like you pay for it. Although since we're dealing with an insane parent, it might be that if the parent has an estate that you could. Right, that you could pay for them out of their own estate. My premise would be that if the parents have an estate, that the funds come out of that, and failing that, the obligation devolves on you. But I can't prove that. Okay, yes, you do.
Why did he use the word Vayitzaker? He should have used the word Yishalem or Yisacher.
I think it means command, you know, command with money. Yeah, I think so. Yes.
Probably also always true, right? I mean, let's say someone has parents who can't pay their bills anymore, can't feed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's obvious that a child would always have to pay for the parents' food if they're...
Good. Almost everybody agrees with you, right? Says that, right? And we actually, that's the stage we skipped in the Gemara, that even if you say Mishalav, that doesn't mean that if your parents are starving, that you should not have an obligation to them that precedes your obligations to other poor. Right? Whether you have an obligation to them that to give more to them than you would give out of your ordinary tzedakah budget. Right, it's an interesting question, right? How you choose between your own standard of living and their standard of living, but that you shouldn't let your parents starve and just say, I have no relationship to them, right? You're allowed to you should have a relationship that precedes. Yes, that's true. Okay. But the first defense is some notion of unreasonability, but that is a very high standard. The standard is insanity. But, you know, that certainly works in some abuse cases where you can just say, you know, a relationship just becomes utterly unreasonable from the standpoint of mental health. And at that point, you can, you can recuse yourself. And that, you know, the question is, here we're talking about caretakers, but sometimes it's not an issue of caretakers. Sometimes the issue, right, sometimes the issue is wholly a function of the relationship, and there's nothing that your parents really need from you. In those cases, I think that the answer is that there's a heter. That one is not, I think one way of generalizing is that there's no obligation to risk one's mental health for kibud av vayim. At such point, it becomes unreasonable for you to recuse yourself, and that I'll say that, you know, that Shaila has come up to me several times. People ask, you know, people say that simply the maintenance of a relationship with their parents drives them crazy, in a very deep sense, you know, like makes them suicidal. An early question I got was of, you know, terrifying question, but of somebody who had one parent who had physically abused them, and was, you know, by all indications, but probably might continue to do so, and another parent who kept asking them to come home. And, you know, and I said, flee. You know, straightforward, flee. You know, it's not you can't be involved in that situation. That's one, right? That's one, I think, fairly straightforward thing, which really should prevent one from using the Dhamma ben Asena story as saying that one is obligated to put up with abuse. And there's lots of attempts among the commentators to distinguish between the different kinds of insanity, those which you can simply tolerate and say they don't really mean anything by it, and those which are actually malicious, which you have no which you really have no obligation to withstand whatsoever. Okay, second line of defense. We're now at source number 6. So there's a braita which says, how do we know that if your father, who is a kohen, tells you who are a kohen, that you should violate the prohibition of becoming tamei meit? Or if you wish to return a lost object and your parent tells you, do not return the lost object, how do we know that you're supposed to disobey? So the answer is because we have the verse that we saw before juxtaposes the obligation of Yirat Av Ve'Em with the obligation of Shabbat, and by a quite fancy piece of halachic leisure domain, we get this to mean that quite astonishingly, we get Shabbat to stand for all mitzvot, and we say that because Shabbat overrides Yirat Av Ve'Em, therefore all mitzvot override Yirat Av Ve'Em, and magically we end up with the claim, it's actually a very beautiful piece of magic, that parents orders, specifically parental orders, do not stand against halacha. Any order, right, that there's any illegal order is not, any illegal order is not binding. Now that begs the question of who decides the order is illegal. And it seems to imply that there is an obligation of obedience except when it contradicts the law. But it does, right, it does offer a straightforward defense. So now you can, if the way I'm framing it, if parental orders are a genuine risk to your mental health, Or if parental orders are directly in violation of halacha, then you have to, then you do not have to obey. In fact, you're obligated to disobey in the second case. And here we have an interesting, now we have two contrasting pieces of rhetoric. The Shulchan Aruch says that you have to absorb it because you're just supposed to think of God. And the Gemara says you don't have to obey because you're all obligated towards God. So your parents cannot in any way command you in a way that would violate your obligations to God. And the Gemara doesn't put up with the thing, but didn't God also command you to respect your parents? The Gemara just doesn't put up with that at all. Yes?
Interestingly, you can't argue with them whether you're right.
Aha. That's true. But maybe you can't argue, you can just act differently. Correct? It may be a purely verbal, maybe you should say, I'm not going to do it because I think you taught me last week. That you were supposed to. Okay. Now then there's what I think is a much, much more powerful claim, which is a Gemara in Hanmoy Katan Daf Yud Zayin. This is also one of the cool feminist Gemaras, so we should all quote it also, because one of the places where women get to make halachic rulings and enforce them. So we have a character known as the Amsa Devei Rebbe, the maidservant of Rebbe's household. Chazite lahu gavra d'havi machiliv no hagadol. She sees somebody beating up his adult son. But presumably beating up his adult son in a disciplinary fashion. And we're going to leave out the question of what the boundary of adult is, as sort of an unfortunate attempt to give a specific age as to what gadol here means, which I think should probably be best avoided. What it means in context is she sees somebody giving corporal punishment to a child at an age at which it is not socially reasonable to expect the child to experience it as discipline as opposed to assault. And she puts the man in cherem. Now, why does she put the man in cherem? She puts the man in cherem because she says there is an obligation not to place a stumbling block in front of the blind. Now, we have talked on occasion that the obligation to place a stumbling block in front of the blind, according to the rabbis, may not prohibit you from placing a stumbling block in front of a blind person, because the rabbis understand it purely metaphorically. And they think that, right, they think that it means that you can't, as opposed to the Kut, the Samaritans, who the rabbis understand as taking it fully literally. And they say that it involves causing somebody else, creating a situation in which somebody else is more likely to sin than they would have otherwise. Okay, I'm not going to bracket the technical details of it. Let's define it that way. And so what Rebbe's maidservant said was that if you administer physical punishment to an adult child, it's a reasonable expectation that the child will hit you back. Hitting you back is at the least a violation of Kavod and Yira, and if it was extreme, it's a violation of Makeh. So you are not allowed to do things that will cause your children to behave improperly towards you. Now, there we have an extreme case, right, that you can't hit them if they will hit you back. But what happens if obedience is an obligation? Right, so you should not be allowed to issue commands that children are likely to disobey. Now, this is, of course, is kind of extreme because it gives children absolute power. Right? All you have to do is create a reasonable presumption that you will not take out the garbage when asked to, and then it becomes prohibited for your parents to ask. Right? Because you just look at them and say, "Hey, let's stay there." And the goal for children is to create the largest possible presumption of disobedience, and thereby completely eliminate any capacity of parents to command them. So we have to figure out.
The garbage can
is a mop shelf. Very good. Yes, Yehuda.
One problem with that is you're making a jump. Just because they're not allowed to issue these orders and do these things doesn't mean you don't have to obey them.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. So this is only a verbal defense, as of now. Right? All you can do is tell your parents you should not issue that order. But if they issue the order anyway, you are still bound, so far. Okay, absolutely right. And this halacha also, just to be aware, is framed programmatically in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says it is forbidden for a person to make his yoke heavy on his children and to be insistent on his kavod so that he not bring them to stumble, right? So he doesn't come them to, right? Rather, parents should forgive and overlook them because you're entitled to forego your honor. Okay, so now we start having a balancing act. On the one hand, children have obligations that we can frame in this very extreme fashion. And on the other hand, parents have the obligation to seek to minimize those obligations, such that actually parents are in violation if they create a circumstance in which it is likely that that children will disobey. And that's, in terms of a family dynamic, that's an important thing to recognize, right? That you can't, at some point, parents have to take obligation. You can't just keep shouting "kibud av v'aim" at people and say it's their obligation. No, right? If it didn't work, right? If it didn't work, whatever it was you were planning on, right? You were hoping that your children would come bring you your slippers each morning and breakfast in bed, but they're not, right? So to keep saying you have an obligation to kibud av v'aim, I order you to bring me my breakfast in bed, doesn't work, right? You're violating it as well. So that's a defense built into the dynamic of the relationship, and it sets out what I think is actually what's going to end up being the overall halachic perspective, which is children should perceive themselves as having the extreme of an obligation, and parents should perceive the children as having no obligation at all, right? Or should seek to avoid imposing the obligation to the extent possible. Okay, so now we have two explicit defenses, right? Your own mental health, or a claim of illegality. One implicit defense, which is that you can suggest that that a command which is likely to be disobeyed is a violation of Lishnei Iver. So now we go on to source number 9, where there's a dispute among the rabbis as to whether a mamzer is chayav in kibud av v'aim. After all, their parents are obviously, parents are adulterers. So do you have an obligation of kibud av v'aim towards your parents? This particular act, right? Your parents are just right now just asking you to bring them a glass of water. But they are sinners. So there's the obligation of kibud av v'aim applied towards sinners. So the Rambam quotes a fascinating Gemara. Gemara raises the question, what happens if you inherit property from your parents that, at least as a result of inheritance, you have no legal obligation to return? But the object is one that causes constant shame to your parents. Every time people see the object, they look at it and they say, that is the object that your parents acquired illegally. Do you have an obligation to return the object so as to sustain your parents' honor? And the Talmud says, only if they repented. But if they died without having repented of their sins, so why is this your problem? And it seems to suggest, right, the Rambam's extension of this to Mamzerut, says explicitly this applies in the lifetime of parents also, that parents who have. Right, the standard it gives is osema seyamcha. Parents who do not behave in the manner of the Jewish people, are not subject to the obligations of honor. And if you look at this, the derivation from the verse does not just mean that you don't have to honor them in this. The derivation of the verse seems to suggest that the obligation of honor only applies to parents who are in good standing in the community. If parents who are not in good standing in the community, there simply is no obligation to honor at all. Yes, Roger.
I mean, it's interesting because when I first read the Mamzer, I figured the parents may have done one bad act 20 years ago, and the parents may be otherwise, fine people, and they did this one bad act 20 years ago. And this is sort of assuming, no, this guy, you're a Mamzer because your parents, lived with their sister or whatever terrible thing they did their whole lives, and now you got to get them. Now you got to get them to convert. I mean, what's the difference if you're a momzer or not? Let's say I'm not a momzer, but my parents started to live with their sister.
Absolutely right. Or if your parents were simply bad people. They were sweatshop owners.
I would just stick to a riot, which is a very serious thing here. But the fact that the son is a momzer, is like almost tangential to the fact how the parents are.
Absolutely, no, it's just an easy case, right? A momzer knows, right? A momzer knows prima facie that his parents have committed a biblical.
You can never repent.
Why not?
Well, if you do, because it's one of those sins you can't repent from. It's The son's always a mamzer, and the parents have.
Yeah, well, the parent, you can't make it up, but you can repent. You can lie in the dust in the synagogue and have people walk over you every day.
It doesn't work to die. This is one of those sins that except for your death, you're not.
Well, we could talk about it after death, but I think that you can be accepted into the community again. That's what, right? The standard is osem ma'asemcha. Are you in good standing in the community? That's what it sounds like. And so you, right? If people commit adultery and they publicly repent, then we had a case like this in Beit Din a while back, where somebody was caught in flagrante delicto, right? And he wanted an aliyah, and the question was, what kind of public repentance did he have to do in order to become accepted as a member in good standing in the community again? We did not adopt the medieval expedient of requiring him to lie down in the dust at the synagogue and have people walk over him on the way in every day for a month and then take his clothes off in the winter and sit outside in a barrel of ice water. And it goes on for 20 or so pages. But we didn't do that. But there is a way to get back into the community. There's almost no sin which we actually permanently expel people. How God keeps score is a different matter. Okay, we're going to see in a moment, though, that this standard, which is still a fairly high standard, right, to get out of Kibbutz Avim, your parents still, it sounds like they have to be defined as a Rasha, and they have to be not in good standing of the community. But now an amazing thing happens in the response of the Rush. So the Rush says the following: regarding a father who commanded his son not to speak with a particular Jew and not to forgive him for what he had done until a specified time. So it sounds like a son and somebody else had an argument, and for some reason the father wants the argument to go on for 2 weeks. We don't know why. Might just be that he thinks that there's a political battle he'll win because if they don't reconcile. Might be there's a business deal he thinks the other person will be excluded from. Might be he's really angry. It's a very strange thing to say, I order you not to forgive him for a week or 2 weeks. But the son... The son's a good guy, and he wants to reconcile. So he comes and he asks the Rush, My father ordered me not to speak with him, not to reconcile with him, but I want to. Do I have to obey my father's command? So the Rush does not say there's no obligation of command, which is a reasonable thing. He could have said that. He doesn't take that. He assumes that there is an obligation to obey commands. But here's his way out. He says, first of all, the Torah forbids you to hate Jews unless you actually see them transgressing. So your father, by commanding you to hate somebody, is causing you to violate the Torah. Now that's pretty extreme, because the father is not commanding you to hate anybody. The father is commanding him not to reconcile with somebody. Right? He could love him in his heart all he wants. Right? The prohibition, presumably, is about an emotion. The father's command is about a political expression. So that's a huge stretch that the Rush makes there. And then he goes further. The Rush says, furthermore, the father in this matter was not doing the deeds of your nation, so he does not need to honor and dignify him. Now, if he really believed that the father's command was illegal, he wouldn't need the second answer. He wouldn't need the standard of Osem Ma'asem Cha. Right? He would, right? Right? We already know that there is an explicit standard that parents can't issue illegal orders. Osem Ma'asem Cha is a way of denying the parent person, right? It's not that the parent's command is illegal, it's that the parent is not worthy of respect. So now what the Rush does here is he says that the standard of Osem Ma'aseh Amcha means even if your parents do things that are wrong. Right? Osem Ma'aseh Amcha is now defined as doing actions which are not illegal, because we wouldn't need this reason if they were illegal. But doing, right, and we can probably say they don't violate any formal prohibition. Just your parents do something which is wrong, and he escalates, because it's not just that you have the right to disobey orders that are wrong; it's you have the right to not provide kibud to a parent who issues orders that are wrong, or for that matter, does anything else which is wrong, because osem ma'asemcha has now been defined out of halakha into the realm of actions which you simply think are wrong. Okay. Yes, Hannah?
It's so notable that he doesn't just say Osem Ma'asem Cha,
yeah,
and just justify it right away. He still includes the argument that the specific issue is semi-legal.
Yeah.
If you really just thought, you didn't have to, that God in this instance, the Nosema Semcha was really enough to justify, you really don't have to listen to them ever. He could just exclude the first reason. It still sounds like,
yeah, because it's a really weak argument.
What?
Because it's a really weak argument.
So you think they're both weak on their own, so you stick them together, so then that's
yeah.
Not to listen in this instance.
But now we've got a precedent.
These are really lowering the standard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's wait. You'll see how it gets used. Right? But it's a pretty dramatic thing. You could use this argument to say that once upon a time, my parents told me to duck under the turnstile because I was six according to my Hebrew, my English birthday, not according to my Hebrew.